This is Read On Air with Red Zell. For those passionate about books.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about reading that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we'll be investigating some of Britain's top crime writers. Kate London provides evidence that crime is alive and kicking with her new novel, Death Message.
It's a book about living for the two main protagonists, Sarah and Lizzie.
Peter Robinson gives us the intel on DCI Banks.
The books are mainly about Banks, about the things that happen to him in his job, i.e. catching criminals.
I unearth a sparkler buried way back in my past, and we say a long goodbye to Colin Dexter.
The person who influenced me more than anybody else was Agatha Christie. She was the great guru in those days.
That's all coming up in today's show. From its earliest beginnings in the Rue Morgue, via characters who've become household names like Sherlock Holmes, Miss Marple and Morse, crime fiction has always been a publishing phenomenon. Kate London is a rising star in the firmament of British crime writers. She first appeared on the show back in January to tell us about her critically acclaimed debut, Post-Mortem. It's a gripping, poignant novel in which she draws on her service in the Met to produce a perfect blend of police procedural and character-led crime thriller. During that interview, she let slip some clues about her eagerly anticipated sequel. So, when Death Message was published earlier this week, simultaneously in print and audio, I decided it was time to bring her back in for further questioning. But first, I needed some evidence. So here, courtesy of Whole Story Audiobooks, is Exhibit A, a sample taken from the opening scene of Death Message.
The Great Storm of 1987 was the before and after of Claire Mills' life. More than 20 years later, she still woke in the middle of the night with a sudden ice-cold alarm that had her sitting up and seeing with luminous clarity those uprooted trees and crushed vehicles. The terror in her heart in the lonely hours of the morning was always the same, that the smaller traces of disaster in her life that she had chosen to ignore for so long had, on the morning after the storm, been emphatically written on the landscape, crying out for her to notice them at last. Among the many, many reproaches she made to herself was this one. She had failed to pay attention to portents. She had known her daughter had secrets. She had known, too, that her husband was having an affair. But whenever she had thought of his all-too-obvious infidelity, and she admitted to herself now that she had strived not to think of it, her sideways-glancing decision had always been to ignore it. It would blow over. His affair had perhaps not been the cause of what happened, but it was another symptom of her willful somnambulism. She had been too attached to her becalmed life. She had kept a tidy house. She had loved her central heating and fitted carpets, the newly installed Everest windows. When daylight came, it offered the consolations of reason. The storm had, perhaps, facilitated in some way what followed, but it had surely been no supernatural harbinger. Still, each year, whenever the days shortened into autumn, she faced alone her belief that her own willful blindness had brought such disaster on her. Those trees, those upturned roots.
Kate London, thank you very much for joining me in the Read On Air studio again.
It's a pleasure.
I get the impression that you chose the title Death Message equally deliberately as you chose Post-Mortem. Could you tell us exactly what the title Death Message refers to?
Well, in police talk, death message is when you have to tell the next of kin that somebody has died. It's usually a memorable experience to go to somebody's house and tell them that unexpectedly somebody they love has died. And I think the sort of pun, as there was a pun on Post-Mortem, is I suppose it's a book about living for the two main protagonists, Sarah and Lizzie.
And that image of the trees uprooted by violence by the storm in 1987 that the book starts with is one that resonates throughout the book. The fact that the detectives are investigating skeletal remains that have been unearthed by violent acts. And I think you at one point say, you know, Sarah Collins sees her job as giving the anonymous victims of London their importance back.
I think she says that she had thought that she could represent small people against the sort of tide of indifference, and she's standing by the Thames when she thinks this, and that after the experience of post-mortem that she feels less confident of that, shaken. And I think that the two characters, Lizzie and Collins, are both uprooted by what's happened in the novel before. So you have obviously the turned earth after the storm, and the fact that a girl is missing and that family is constantly uprooted and never able to settle, but also that the two main protagonists are in a similar state.
Yes, that they actually have to assume the grief of the friends and relatives of the missing or murdered victims that they're looking into.
Yes, and I think you see with Lizzie that she's resistant, that she doesn't want to get involved in the people that she's tasked with investigating and so on. She resists it, but she becomes, you know, more and more involved. So I suppose it's quite a redemptive novel in a way for the two female protagonists.
And I think, I mean, I certainly hadn't realised that murder investigation teams investigate two cases concurrently, that there's a cold case and an active case. Is that standard procedure within the Met?
Yes. Major investigation teams, MIT teams, will have any number of investigations running at any particular time. They have a period, which is in the book, which was when they're on call for 7 days, where they will respond to live incidents, so somebody who's likely to die, a high-risk missing person, or a murder, or indeed a manslaughter. But then they will also have ongoing cases, and they will have cold case reviews, historic cases that come back up, that they will review the evidence. And I think one of the brilliant things is that an undetected murder isn't closed in the Met. It's looked at on a regular basis in case there are leads that can lead to detecting it.
So I know that you don't take actual cases and write about them, but the reinvestigation of somebody who disappeared in 1987 and whose body has never been found is something perfectly plausible for a MIT team to be looking into.
Yes. Absolutely. A case like that would be reviewed if the person was believed to have come to harm. And if there was any new evidence, resources would be put into it. And if you Google cold cases or historic cases, you will find that the Met does get detections for them, and that they're always a cause for celebration, that even though they often bring bad news and they turn the earth, as it were, of the experiences of the next of kin, at the same time, they do bring resolution for people.
Yes, I thought you handled that very sensitively and very thought-provokingly, that I know one of the detectives asked herself, well, what would we be wishing for if this girl were still to be alive? You know, she would have been imprisoned, she would have had awful things done to her. Maybe it's better actually to turn up a dead body so that people can move on.
Well, I don't think I say quite that, but I think one of the things about people who are missing is that the families worry so very much where they are and what's happening to them, and that there's something desperate about that open question. And so resolution is helpful. I don't think it's better for people to be dead, but I think a resolution is really important for people, and it's very desperate for people not to know what's happened.
And as you said, both your detectives are moving on from post-mortem, and that's in very stark contrast to the mother of the missing girl who is caught in this kind of stasis. But both your detectives are just moving on to the next traumatic incident. You say there's a redemption at the end of the novel, but both of them have been put through the ringer again. You don't pull any punches about how traumatic and difficult policing in 21st century London can be.
Well, it's interesting because the book's just been serialised, and I've had brilliant readership who've been incredibly responsive and warm and involved. But one of the things they've talked about is how hard policing is. But I think that is partly a product of this particular book, where these two women are really in a state of trying to resolve how they feel about their job and whether they can continue to do their job after the experiences of the last book. And I think that when you do it, it isn't like that all the time. And also there's an enormous joy and pleasure in policing, which probably doesn't come across in this book because that isn't what this book's about. But there's an enormous satisfaction in delivering justice for people.
It's certainly something that I think comes out in the squad room humour that you have, such as when the team gather together to investigate the current murder.
The duty inspector had rounded up CID from all over the nick, and the drinks machine shuddered loudly as it dispensed Coke and Red Bull. Ash had celebrated the news by bringing the biscuit tin from the office to the canteen, and everyone was digging in, the tin rapidly emptying.
"I'm a rebel, me,"
he said in a fake northern accent. "Can't wait to see the DI's face in the morning when all the biscuits have gone. Do you think she'll put a crime report on?" An officer, in the act of stuffing two biscuits in his mouth at the same time, said, "You're fine, mate. No witnesses." The duty inspector walked briskly into the canteen and sat at one of the tables. "When you're ready." They gathered round, mostly standing. She handed out the hastily printed briefing sheets. "With the station Grapevine fully operational, I expect most of you will already know what this is about." Lizzie was staring at the briefing. At the top was a custody image of a white male, round head, short cropped hair, QPR shirt. It was the most recent image, taken the last time he'd been nicked. She looked down the page and saw the name of the victim. She pulled out a chair and sat down. Ash was looking in her direction, but she avoided him, gazing steadfastly at the briefing sheet. Inspector Redwood was still talking.
As a woman who served in the Metropolitan Police for several years, do you think that women bring a different perspective to detection?
What I'd say more is that you need a mix of people. It isn't necessarily to do with whether they're male or female, but different experiences, different attitudes. You know, there's the guy who can sit there with the spreadsheet and just concentrate on the spreadsheet all day, and that is very important detective work, but it isn't for everybody. And then there's the guy who can go along and talk to the guy who's fencing stolen goods and persuade him to talk to him. And again, that's a different skill. Not everybody's going to have that skill. And there's the person who can go, not necessarily a woman. I went with a brilliant man in his 50s once to deliver a death message, and he was so fantastic at being there and listening and saying the right thing and not saying too much. So I think it's more that you really need a big range of personalities and people.
Clearly, the delivering of death messages must have affected you quite deeply. I mean, you certainly bring the detective's eye for detail to the minutiae of how relatives react and how they slowly crumple, or they slowly put up walls, or and how it's not a static state. It's
yes, and everybody's different, and everyone is surprising. You know, it isn't what you expected. It isn't the same every time. Yes, they stay with you, definitely.
I think one of the fascinating aspects of the book is having the two female protagonists.
And of course, Fat Elaine now.
And Fat Elaine, who's a wonderful character, and and coaxed away from the biscuit tin, which I think is just terrific. But you give the three, two or three aspects of policing that Sarah Collins plays very much by the book. Lizzie is rather instinctive. And both of them have aspects of those two vital areas of detection, but in different measure. Was it something you felt very much was a struggle between those aspects of detection whilst you were looking into cases?
There are people who have an incredibly good nose. They call it a copper's nose. And the Met has this award every year of best thief taker, which is controversial and some people don't like it. But there was a PC on my ground who was extraordinary how he would bring arrests in. Good arrests, you know, how he would know. And you would look at him and think, how do you know? I used to think he was like an ANPR, a one-man ANPR system, that he must sit on the tube and go, ping, ping, ping. So it definitely exists, this instinct, but it needs to be balanced up. And again, I think that comes across in the book, where the DCI is much more certain that if somebody's a wrong'un, that they've done the crime.
Mm.
But then again, he's got a point.
And also, it can drag you up blind alleys. It can.
That's right. And people can get fixated on a suspect and they follow that person and follow and put a lot of resources into that person. And we know there are famous cases where this has happened and the other person quietly slips away.
Mm. Which I suppose is why these cold case reviews are so useful, to bring a fresh pair of eyes to a case.
Yes. And of course, technology moves on. And that's the other thing that catches up with some people, is that they didn't realise that they were leaving DNA behind because it hadn't been so prevalent.
And one of the other senses of loss that comes through the book is for a time past, for a time that actually isn't in the so distant past, 1987, but which represents something, a country where things were done differently, you know,
yes.
where cardboard boxes were rigid and where you had physical photographs.
Yes, and carbon copies of things. And people didn't routinely use computers, and telephone codes were different. And you lived through the time, if you're my age, you were alive during the Great Storm, but the past is a different country. It's, you know, the question of how much we change. And I suppose that's relevant to Sarah Collins in it, because there's a lot of Sarah Collins' backstory in explaining who she is and where she is and what she needs to do in order to become more fully herself.
And there's also the question of how policing has changed in those years. I mean, I was a great fan of The Sweeney, and we've had programmes like Ashes to Ashes on the television, which, you know, show a rougher, tougher police force. And yet the police force of 2014, 2015 in Death Message seem almost constrained by the justice system. It's almost as if they're in a bare-knuckle fight, asking to play by Queensbury rules.
I mean, I think the police themselves talk about pre-PACE, which is a piece of legislation, the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, and post-PACE, and they're very different worlds, because there's much more limits now, limits on detention, how long you can keep people in, very strict identification procedures, very strict rules about interviews and what's admissible. And it's a much better world, and the quality of evidence is much better, I think. But I think, yes, of course, that's coupled up with a worry that sometimes the police feel they can't do their jobs. I mean, there's a huge issue at the moment, I think, in London about pursuits, that the police are very frightened and unwilling, and I believe don't very much pursue mopeds anymore. And yet we know that a lot of crime is enabled, serious crime, robbery and so on, is moped enabled. It's very difficult. You've got to care about the people on the bikes and that they don't die, but you've also got to care about the victims of crime. And it's, I think it's very hard to balance up those two things. And in the middle of it, I think police officers get caught up and they don't know how to do their job. They feel damned if they do and damned if they don't, with serious consequences.
But I suppose in that you're also removing the loopholes whereby people can slip out of a conviction.
I think it's really complicated, and I don't have the answers. But I think also another thing that you're having is that there was a time when police could go to an incident and think, it's not really a good idea for these people to get arrested. The best thing is for us to sort it out, get them to say sorry to each other and move on. That was problematic because domestic violence perpetrators weren't arrested and so on, and people who needed to be arrested weren't arrested. But there is another side of the spectrum where sometimes it is better to show discretion. And I think that police are more and more frightened to show discretion, and that perhaps people are arrested and cautioned inappropriately. At the end of the day, society needs to give clearer guidance to police what exactly they want, because at the same time they can go on being furious that somebody hasn't been prosecuted for an offence, or outraged that somebody's been arrested for an offence. It's very difficult.
I certainly came away feeling that I had a better view of the police and the job that they did, and realising that the portrayals that we get on television are rather two-dimensional.
The thing that drives me insane is when people think that policing is really simple and why don't people just do it properly? Peter Hitchens is very keen in his columns to say that it's straightforward and that the police should simply do this. It is a difficult job. It is a challenging job. It has all sorts of people working in it. I think that makes for good stories. I think the different kinds of people... I mean, you could say that the DCI in this book... Perhaps you find him unsympathetic, I don't know. But I like him. You know, he's... Yes, they call him the bulldozer. He might not be up to speed. He's definitely pre-pace. And yet there's also something marvellous about him. I mean, the idea that he sings It's Not Unusual at job dues and so on. And he'll back his troops, and he likes to get results, and he doesn't bear a grudge.
And yet there are other people who are clearly post-pace and do everything by the book and can't see beyond the blinkers, which I suppose, as you said earlier, you need a bag of all sorts.
Yeah, absolutely. You need everybody working together, and if you're lucky, that's what a good team feels like.
Thanks, Kate, and we'll be hearing more from her later in the show. Hot off the press, Death Message is available commercially, and it really is unputdownable.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille, giant print and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
As we reported on this programme, Colin Dexter passed away in March. The creator of Inspector Morse achieved the rare distinction of seeing his characters inhabit lives beyond the 13 novels and handful of short stories he wrote about them. Back in 2013, he chatted to Robert Kirkwood about this and how he was drawn into a life of crime writing.
Inspector Morse is frequently mentioned in the same breath as Sherlock Holmes or Hercule Poirot as one of the great detectives. He first appeared in the Colin Dexter book, Last Bus to Woodstock.
The evening's merriness wilted like a sad balloon, and voices gradually hushed as the whispered rumour spread. There had been a murder. None seemed anxious to leave. Two or three asked if they could phone. All felt suddenly sober, including a pale-faced young man who stood in the manager's office and whose scarcely touched whiskey still stood on the counter of the cocktail lounge. With the arrival of Sergeant Lewis and two uniformed constables, a small knot of people gathered curiously on the pavement outside. It did not escape their notice that the police car had parked immediately across the access to the courtyard, effectively sealing the exit. 5 minutes later, a second police car arrived, and eyes turned to the lightly built, dark-haired man who alighted. He conversed briefly with the constable, who stood guard outside, nodded his head approvingly several times, and walked into the Black Prince. He knew Sergeant Lewis only slightly, but soon found himself pleasurably impressed by the man's level-headed competence.
Robert Gladwell reading Last Bus to Woodstock by Colin Dexter. And although not mentioned by name, that lightly built, dark-haired man's entrance heralded the first appearance of Inspector Endeavour Morse, although it'd be a few years before we found out that first name. Author Colin Dexter joined me on the line from his and Morse's native Oxford, and we chatted about his influences and how to write a great crime novel.
The only thing that I ever did, which applied to everything I wrote, not just crime books, was the fact that I used to know the end before the beginning. In the criminological world, as you probably know, you hear those people who think that everything springs from character, and this is what's the key thing in a crime story. I never understood that at all, because I was very glad to have one idea, and that was the finish. And people say to me, you know, did you know the end before the beginning? And I just have to be honest and say, you know, if I didn't know the end, I'd never know the beginning. I wouldn't know where to go. So I think the biggest influence in my life, which is not all that great really, would be my parents weren't literate at all. They were, both of them left school at the age of 12, so they had no, as it were, secondary knowledge of what we would think of the normal classics in English literature. And I remember we had three books only in the house when I was a lad, and they were Medicine Today, which was a big, thick book, and I think it was published in 1886. And, you know, it didn't really give any up-to-date medicines to take or anything. That was one book which was often consulted. And secondly, we had Sacred Songs and Solos, which we all had to study and learn the words. Not that we were a religious family, but I think father and mother were in choirs. One of them was in a choir conducted by Malcolm Sargent, so he knew all about hymns. If we did read any books, we used to have Smith's Lending Library when I was a young lad. I've often blessed ever since people who founded the local libraries.
Now, most of the Morse audiobooks are narrated by actors involved in the TV series, but there are a few rarer ones that were narrated by yourself.
I didn't have much to do with audiobooks, except I was asked to do it, and I did three, I think, of my own books. I think I got the sack after three books. They said, you know, you did write this, didn't you? You're not reading it as if you know, you understand what's going to happen next. Well, there's some truth in that, except that I always knew how it was going to end. And I very often get asked that question. You know the great controversy about characterization, you know, fires the whole thing. And the plot is secondary. I've always felt exactly the opposite to that. I've always felt the hardest thing in life is to get some twist, because the person who influenced me more than anybody else was Agatha Christie. I never met Agatha Christie, but she was the great guru in those days, and I've admired her enormously. Of all the crime writers I've known, all of them, she had more imagination than almost all of us put together. A wonderfully fertile mind for plot. But a wonderful woman. But I believe that I never met her. But they said she was very shy. And although she was a chairman for several years of the Detection Club, I don't think she was ever a public persona. Somebody like P.D. James, who's absolutely marvellous with the public, 92 years old now and speaks as if she's a spring chicken. I think she's a remarkable woman, and we're very good friends. But I don't find it at all easy to read books at the moment. But my eyes are not getting worse, so I'm happy from that point of view.
Now, off air, we were chatting about your eyesight and a past problem with AMD, and I'm going to get you to repeat what you said about getting going for an eye examination.
You know, everybody getting older these days, including you, my dear friend. If you don't go, as my girl who looks after me at the John Ratcliffe Hospital in Oxford here. It's no good saying it was 3 years ago, and if you say, well, 1 year, then I will make it up as you go along. And she said to me, you ought to go every 6 months, but I think it's an enormous importance for everybody to go very regularly. And in the next 10 years, I think there'll be a revolution in so many treatments by medicines.
Mm.
And I've been lucky enough to have this macular degeneration. I suppose you know a few people with macular degeneration.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Just to clarify, you weren't lucky to have AMD, you were lucky to have it successfully treated.
Yes, it was. Yes, the Americans, the women hated it because they couldn't bear the thought of having somebody having to pierce their eyes with a needle. But on the other hand, of course, the whole business of our needles, I've been diabetic since 66, and it is quite remarkable, really, that the biggest single revolution in medicine is that the needles now, instead of being short and fat and stubby and painful, you hardly feel them going in at the moment. I'm on another long course of insulin at the moment. I've been, well, since 66. But it is amazing that you can, you don't feel it these days.
Mm. RNIB have a campaign running called Spot the Signs. How did you spot the signs of your sight loss?
I've always been a big crossword addict, and I decided at one stage that the little numbers in the top right-hand corner, the goalpost corner of the square, individual number 8 across or something like that, that I was misleading myself all the time. Like A's and 3's and the letter lowercase I and the, the uppercase anything sometimes.
Mm.
But I began to think, oh, of course I can't do it. I can't read the clue properly. And so at the moment I don't do crosswords. It's infuriating if you can't read what's on the page.
We definitely need to have some giant print crosswords sent to you from RNIB. There are many, many Colin Dexter books available in the Talking Books Library. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Another leading British crime writer whose detective has become a TV star is Peter Robinson. The creator of DCI Banks also bears the distinction of being the most borrowed author in the RNIB Library. He splits his time between his home in Toronto and his native Yorkshire, which is Banks' patch. But Connect magazine's intrepid reporter, Leanne Coyle, managed to nab him when he dropped into the Talking Books studios.
Hello, my name's Peter Robinson and I'm a novelist. I write a series of books featuring a detective who works in North Yorkshire, and his name is DCI Alan Banks. He works with others. There's Annie's assistant and Winsome he also works with. But, you know, the books are mainly about Banks, about the things that happen to him in his job, i.e. catching criminals, and about things that happen in his life in general.
Well, thank you very much for joining us on Insight Radio. Tell us a bit about how you did start off.
Well, I'd always been writing. Ever since I was, you know, a child, as soon as I could pick up a pencil and make words, I was writing. But my first love was poetry. And for many years from, I'd written short stories, you know, and when I was like 13 or 14, I'd written science fiction novels and short stories and all rubbish, all lost now, I hope. But I really got into poetry. And for many years, until my early 30s, I wrote almost exclusively poetry. And then I found, I sort of wrote myself into a corner. I didn't really know where next to go with it. And I was getting more into formal poetry, rhyme, meter, narrative poetry, telling stories. So, you know, it seemed an almost natural move to go into storytelling through prose. And I happened to be reading crime fiction at that time. I hadn't read any before, but not since I was a teenager, reading Sherlock Holmes and Agatha Christie. But I read Raymond Chandler and Simenon and some other writers and thought, I'd like to do what they do. Yeah. So I gave it a try.
Obviously, as you say, you were reading those types of books at the time, but how did you then go on and do your research and make your story sound realistic, if you like?
I didn't do any research for the
really?
First few books. I didn't know anybody. I mean, I didn't know any police. I didn't really know any other writers. So I suppose, you know, I just took it from other novels I'd read. Like, whatever they did, I sort of did.
It seems to have worked for you.
It's pretty basic. You know, you find a body, there's a forensics going on in the background, unless you really are one of the, you know, the forensics writers who gives all the detail. It's just, for most crime writers, it's something that's going on back there and DNA information comes in. Of course, not when I started, because it wasn't happening then. But, you know, it wasn't that difficult to just miss out the procedural bits that I didn't know and get on with the story. In fact, I think it helped in a lot of ways. Too much research at that stage would probably have bogged me down in detail. But, of course, I mean, as I carried on writing them, I got to know police officers over the years, and they'd say, oh, you know, we wouldn't really do this. And I said, well, tell me what you do. Mm. And so it's to the point now where I can send an email and say, look, I want to do this. Is it viable? But even then, I'm still looking for what I can get away with. I mean, I'm looking for something that would be believable to a reader, but I'm also looking for something that creates the maximum drama. I want to know at what point, even when you're following procedure, things can go wrong, because that's what makes fiction interesting.
You're very well regarded in the world of crime fiction, if you like, and your books are the most borrowed by Talking Book service users, which obviously for the listeners of this show, they'll be very aware of what an accolade that is. What do you think it is, though, that makes your books special or stand out?
I don't know. I mean, it's everyone has a very different style, and I like a slightly old-fashioned descriptive style. I mean, if I start out with a place, which I often do, I like people to get a sense of that place, like to bring all the senses into it. So I think when people read or listen to my books, they can enter into a world that's created for them that has enough connections with the real world to be believable, but is also another world like Coronation Street or The Archers or something like that, you know, an ongoing fictional world, not science fiction, not fantasy, not Lord of the Rings or anything, but, you know, identifiably Yorkshire, but just a slight variation, slight step away from the real one.
Does it mean a lot to you to have your book set in Yorkshire? It's where you were. I understand you have connections with Canada. Were you born in Canada?
No, I was born in Leeds, and I grew up in Leeds. So I didn't go to Canada until my mid-20s for graduate studies. And I'd only been there, you know, 3 or 4 years when I started working on what would be the first DCI Banks books. And I think it was out of nostalgia, a sort of homesickness, you know, that writing about Yorkshire was a way of keeping in touch. And, of course, I would have to go back and, you know, keep up to date with everything and, you know, check out what was happening there and what people were doing and talking about. So it kept me in touch while I was living a long way away.
So it gave you an excuse, really, to go home and and see the family and friends and...
You know, on a sort of snowy Toronto day, I could sit at my computer and pretend it was a rainy Yorkshire day.
That's great. What does that mean to you that your books are firstly made into talking books, so made into an accessible format for blind and partially sighted readers?
Well, I mean, that was always important right from the start, because I remember with the very early books, both here and in Canada, I was actually published first by Penguin Canada. And the organisation is the CNIB, right from the start, started doing the books. And a lot of people had said that, you know, I've done readings all over the place. And why don't you read them yourself? You've got a good reading voice. I'd love to do it, and I told them I would. But the problem, of course, is it is such a professional operation that I would have had to travel, so, you know, quite a distance, and I don't drive. This is in Toronto. And, you know, do an hour or however long the session was, and do that over several weeks. And it was a kind of commitment that was difficult for me at the time. And I'm still traveling a lot. I mean, I spend some of my time over here, some in Canada. If they just give me a little tape recorder to take home, I'd do it. But it's more professional than that. So, I mean, it's always been very important to my books.
Finally, what would you say to anyone listening who is an aspiring writer? You know that saying, everyone has a book in them. So there are many aspiring writers out there. Why do some make it and why don't? And what would your advice be on how to get your writings out there?
There are a number of factors, but I've taught writing courses over the years for many, many years, and I've come across a lot of talented students, you know, a lot of students who write very well. Some have been successful and been published. Those who haven't were not published because they didn't write. They just didn't do it. And a lot of people don't realize they have this idea that they want to be writers, but they don't actually want to write. So my advice is, if you want to be a writer, write. And, you know, don't stop. That's the other thing. I mean, sometimes at the first sign of a publisher not being interested, you know, people are very sensitive about it. It's a very personal thing. Rejection hurts, and they stop. But you do need not only to, you know, put your bum on the chair, your fingers on the keyboard every day if you can, but when it comes back, send it out again. Develop a thick skin.
Yeah, okay. So when those doors are closing in your face, you need to show your commitment by perseverance, by
you need to keep going with it.
Yeah, kick the doors down. Very good advice. Peter Robinson, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Thanks to Leanne and to Peter Robinson. The RNIB Library is free to all RNIB members. For details of a full list of titles available to borrow, why not visit the website rniblibrary.com or ring the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Our instinct was quite correct. It's happened.
Death on the Nile by Agatha Christie.
Poirot straightened up and asked sharply, "What has happened?" "Lynette Doyle is dead."
Poirot investigates a murder on a Nile steamer. All things seem obvious at first, but almost at once, complications multiply.
"I've heard a great deal about you, Monsieur Poirot, and I know that you're a very clever man. It happens that I am urgently in need of someone to help me, and I think very possibly that you're the man who could do it." Poirot inclined his head. "You are very amable, madame, but you see, I'm on a holiday, and when I'm on holiday, I do not take cases." "That could be arranged."
This classic is on Talking Books every day at 2, with a repeat at 10. Or catch up with every aired episode at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.
No discussion of great detective fiction would be complete without Agatha Christie, the original Queen of Crime. Little wonder, then, that she is the author of today's hidden gem, Sleeping Murder, the book that made me want to be a writer. Although it was published posthumously in 1976, Christie had written it decades before to be Miss Marple's last case. Aged 11 and having only just come to the world of grown-up detective stories, by way of The Famous Five and of The Hardy Boys, I was expecting another whodunit like Christie's The Body in the Library. What I got instead was an introduction to psychological crime which sent shivers up my spine and kept me awake all night turning the pages. And for months afterwards, I kept turning the plot over in my head. I was hooked and knew that I too wanted to write stories like Sleeping Murder that played mind games with the reader. By today's standards, the plot is pretty simple. Newlywed Gwenda Reed arrives from New Zealand ahead of her husband and starts house hunting on the south coast of England. The moment she sees Hillside, she knows she's found what she's looking for. It's run down, but it feels strangely like home.
They were starting down the stairs when quite suddenly Gwenda felt a wave of irrational terror sweep over her. It was a sickening sensation, and it passed almost as quickly as it came. And yet it left behind a new idea. The house. It isn't haunted, is it? Demanded Gwenda. Mrs. Hengrave, a step below, and having just got to the moment in her narrative when Major Hengrave was sinking fast, looked up in an affronted manner. Not that I'm aware of, Mrs. Reed. Why? Has anyone been saying anything of the kind? You've never felt or seen anything yourself? Nobody's died here. It was rather an unfortunate question, she thought, a split second of a moment too late, because presumably Major Hengrave... My husband died in the St. Monica's nursing home, said Mrs. Hengrave stiffly. Oh, yes, of course, you told me so. Mrs. Hengrave continued in the same rather glacial manner. In a house which was presumably built about 100 years ago, there would normally be death during that period. Miss Ellsworthy, from whom my dear husband acquired this house 7 years ago, was in excellent health, and indeed planning to go abroad and do missionary work, and she did not mention any recent demises in her family. Gwenda hastened to soothe the melancholy Mrs. Hengrave down. They were now once more in the drawing-room. It was a peaceful and charming room, with exactly the kind of atmosphere that Gwenda coveted. Her momentary panic just now seemed quite incomprehensible. What had come over her? There was nothing wrong with the house. Asking Mrs. Hengrave if she could take a look at the garden, she went out through the French windows onto the terrace. There should be steps here, thought Gwenda, going down to the lawn. But instead, there was a vast uprising of forsythia, which at this particular place seemed to have got above itself and effectively shut out all view of the sea. Gwenda nodded to herself. She'd alter all that.
She moves in and soon starts making improvements. Her instincts seem to tell her what to do. Cutting down the forsythia does indeed give her a view of the sea. When she asks the builders to knock through a wall to link two rooms, they discover an old doorway already there. And when they reopen a long sealed door in the nursery, they find it decorated with exactly the same wallpaper that Gwenda was planning to use. It's all very spooky, as is the irrational fear she always feels on the staircase. So, deciding that she needs a change of scene, Gwenda heads up to London to spend a few days with some cousins. There she meets Miss Marple, an elderly and rather nosy spinster who's filled with foreboding for Gwenda after a strange incident at the theatre during a production of The Duchess of Malfi.
The lights went down. The play began. It was superbly acted, and Gwenda enjoyed it very much. She had not seen very many first-rate theatrical productions. The play drew to a close, came to that supreme moment of horror. The actor's voice came over the footlights, filled with the tragedy of a warped and perverted mentality. Cover her face. Mine eyes dazzle. She died young. And Gwenda screamed. She sprang up from her seat, pushed blindly past the others out into the aisle, through the exit and up the stairs and so to the street. She did not stop even then, but half walked, half ran, in a blind panic up the Haymarket.
Gwenda tells Miss Marple that she'd seen herself watching a man uttering the same words as he strangled a woman called Helen. Determined not to let sleeping murder lie, Miss Marple quickly arranges to stay with a friend near Hillside. All the usual Agatha Christie suspects are there. The angry young man whose actions only put him in a worse light, the feckless friend who seems too unmoved by tragedy to be innocent, and of course the creepy doctor who knows more than he's saying. Then there's a trusty trio of housekeeper, cook and gardener, the flighty nanny and the remote rural setting, giving sleeping murder all the ingredients of the classic country house murder that made Christie famous in the 20s and 30s. But it also has an additional hair-raising quality that takes it beyond the standard whodunit. Christie captures a sense of lurking evil that threatens not only life, but sanity. It's a menace that can poison innocence and lie dormant until disturbed. Christie wrote Sleeping Murder and Poirot's Last Case, Curtain, in London during the Blitz, believing she might be killed at any moment. She bequeathed one each to her husband and her daughter to give them an income and her sleuths a voice in the event of her premature death. As it was, the two books remained with her solicitor until shortly before she died in 1976. Sleeping Murder was called Cover Her Face until 1962, when P.D. James published her debut novel of the same name. I think the book reflects its wartime origins in its darker themes. It shows the reader something more chilling than the crime capers of the Golden Age. The setting is still a country house, but Christie gives us a further dimension by letting us see into Gwenda's mind. It may be a little tame by today's standards, and I'll confess it didn't give me the same frisson when I reread it as it did when I was 11, but Sleeping Murder still remains a fine example of Agatha Christie's tight, inventive plotting and her ability to write a great page-turner. For me, it marks the point at which crime fiction moved from murder in the library to the pathology of fear. The version of Sleeping Murder I downloaded from Overdrive is read by Andrew Timothy and is TB3016. Do you have a book that you think would expand my reading horizons? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Now, as promised, back to Kate London to share the books of her life. So, Kate, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you want to become a writer?
All I can remember is being so involved in reading as a child. I would be the one who's, you know, sat under the table and read. I was the torch under the bed covers reader. I was thinking, it's not a sort of nowadays, a sort of hip thing to have liked to read when you were a child, but I adored the Narnia books. I read them over and over and over again. I loved Mr. Tumnus and I felt so sorry for him. And I think that even as a child I understood that this fawn was being bullied by this queen and that he did a bad thing because he was frightened and then he felt remorse for it. I loved the badgers. They make this wonderful meal before they set off to be brave. And I don't know, those books really spoke to me. I believed that you could go through wardrobes and that you could go through paintings.
"Bring out that creature," said Aslan. One of the elephants lifted Uncle Andrew in its trunk and laid him at the lion's feet. He was too frightened to move. "Please, Aslan," said Polly, could you say something to unfrighten him? And then could you say something to prevent him from ever coming back here again?" "Do you think he wants to?" said Aslan. "Well, Aslan," said Polly, "he might send someone else. He's so excited about the bar off the lamppost growing into a lamppost tree, and he thinks..." "He thinks great folly, child," said Aslan.
And is there a book that you'd curl up with on a sofa on a rainy day and happily reread?
I'm a big rereader. I'm a huge fan of rereading. I've reread many books. I reread Anna Karenina. I read it all the time, actually. Le Carré, some Graham Greene, Colm Tóibín, The Master. Brilliant, fantastic book, beautiful prose. What a sensitive eye, what an extraordinary, almost dispassionate authorial voice he has, and yet compassionate. I don't know which one to go for. Well, I've recently reread Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which is so clever, so brilliant, and which has this description of Smiley sitting in the dark, and he says he's a fat spy with bare feet holding a piece of string. And I just think that he managed to get Smiley in that situation, and to have that description of him is just so clever and so funny.
Unlike Jim Prideaux, Mr. George Smiley was not naturally equipped for hurrying in the rain, least of all at dead of night. Indeed, he might have been the final form for which Bill Roach was the prototype. Small, podgy, and at best middle-aged, he was by appearance one of London's meek who do not inherit the earth. His legs were short, his gait anything but agile, his dress costly, ill-fitting, and extremely wet. His overcoat, which had a hint of widowhood about it, was of that black, loose weave which is designed to retain moisture. Either the sleeves were too long or his arms too short, for as with Roach when he wore his Macintosh, the cuffs all but concealed the fingers. For reasons of vanity, he wore no hat, believing rightly that hats made him ridiculous.
And a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yes, definitely Francis Spufford's On Golden Hill, which is a historic novel set in the United States before it was the United States, when it was still a crown colony, I suppose. And he writes with amazing eye for historical detail and accuracy and language, and yet also with a knowing postmodern viewpoint, where he knows that we can't know everything about these characters that he's writing about, and yet he lets us. And the book twists all the time. You don't know everything until the very, very end. And it's funny too. It's just, I think, a delight. Absolutely wonderful book.
Smith sidled into full shadow and turned off briskly, yet at a walk, upon the usual city rule that a man who does not wish to be noticed, whether he has picked a pocket or pasted a playbill where one is not allowed, should never pick himself out by running. Mistake. He had not made above 20 paces across the uneven grass before the raised voices behind resolved into pounding feet, and a shoulder struck him behind the knees, and he was slammed to the turf beneath a mountain of rapidly augmenting male meat. Freeze against his cheek against the cold dirt, the weight of at least two bodies on his back, excited, spiritous breathing.
"Got him!"
someone cried. Smith was pinned.
Kate London, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading and your books of your life with us. I can't wait to get you back on the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
My thanks again to Kate. And if you'd like to share the books of your life, why not drop us a line by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. So that's all we got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to all of you who've been in touch about your book groups, the titles you've been enjoying, and ideas for books that you think that I should read. Next week, we'll be curling up with some contemporary classics. So if you've any suggestions for titles that you think that we should choose, or want to get in touch about anything that you've heard or read, I'm just an email away. Until then, farewell, my lovelies, and don't forget to read on.